And here we are. Welcome back, Cinema Squabble, episode number 60. We've done it 60 times.
Yeah, I guess we just wanted to wait for the 61, didn't we?
Boy, didn't we. There have been so many films, so many things, so many what's to do's, whoozy what's its and what's to do's its in the last month.
That's because you went on vacation.
Yeah, there's vacation in there. Vacation, fireworks to be had, RV trips to be taken, boat trips to be taken, you name it, man.
I guess we have to forgive him, Eric.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, we're on episode 60, so is anybody still listening?
I would say...
I hope so.
We've had a few comments from people going, when are you coming back? So, Adam Gerke here, Sarah Michelle Fetters, Eric Samdel, and you know us all from Cinema Squabbles of your, or of Christmas past, as it were. And Eric comes to us from Film Jabber, Sarah from MovieFreak.com. I do a bunch of writing on my own blog, but also write for a wire service here in Seattle. We're a number of Seattle's film critics. We gather in theaters several times a week. We watch films, we discuss films, and we usually do that in a theater, and now we bring that discussion to you in podcast form. Because we've been gone for so long, why don't we just kind of just dial it back a little bit, at least a week, and talk about, because there's, I mean, otherwise we could go into many things.
We'll talk about how awesome this July has been in a little bit.
We'll just do
an overview of the most amazing July I've ever seen as a professional film critic.
Yeah, it's been pretty spectacular. So
how's that for a teaser?
That's a tease, and I think also, I mean, we'll find out what's ringing Sarah's bell, so to speak, in that regard. But kicking it right off, let's talk a little bit about Atomic Blonde. This is Charlize Theron making her return to the cinema as an undercover MI6 agent. She's Lorraine Broughton, and she's sent into East Berlin just days before the fall of communism and the Berlin Wall, in search of secrets capable of propelling the Cold War indefinitely. And then she's helped or hindered by James McAvoy, a guy by the name of Percival, and kind of stationed in Berlin, East Berlin, West Berlin. He kind of is a man of both sides of the wall in some regard. And she's surviving her time in Berlin, trying to do that, navigating the underbellies of intelligence. That's kind of the name and the miracle of it in itself. Meanwhile, she's a lean, mean, killing machine, and this job may actually be even too much for her to handle. But she's got people to report back to, including John Goodman, Toby Jones, James Faulkner. The list goes on. Can she do it?
Yeah, it's an amazing cast.
Yeah, it really is. It's one of those things, though, where you got this fantastic cast. Are they all put to use? I think that's the big question.
No, I already forgot about all of them except for the two main characters.
Really? Did you?
Yeah. Which actually says a lot about the film.
They literally just sit in a room and do nothing. Mm. A complete waste of the rest of that cast.
No. By and large. I think Goodman gets a couple nice little moments. Yeah. But especially Jones and Faulkner, both of whom are just extraordinary actors. They really don't get much to do. You know, when you're talking about Atomic Blonde, what you're going to talk about are the action sequences.
Absolutely.
And the movie is directed by David Lett, who was the co-director, the silent co-director of John Wick. He's a longtime stuntman, a longtime stunt coordinator. The dude is like a melding of John Woo and Vincente Minnelli, or Gene Kelly. I think I compared him to Gene Kelly meets John Woo in my review.
Huh.
Because the action sequences are these balletic, long take, single camera, choreographed to an inch of their life masterpieces. I mean, and you think you've seen everything that they can throw at you early on. I mean, there's this great little escape from a car. Mm-hmm. There's another escape from some East German policemen at one point that's really well done. And then in the last, kicking off the last third of the film, off the climax is a 10-minute
staircase,
uninterrupted, single take.
Or alleged single take. There's a couple crossings of camera that actors do, which would provide an edit if they wanted to do an edit.
The only thing that leads me to believe that, because they all claim it's a single take thing.
Okay.
And the only thing that leads me to believe is when you get to the end of it, all of the actors are physically exhausted to the point where they are just falling over. And it's so realistic, you really believe that they are that exhausted.
Yeah.
And that's what makes the movie work, though, is like, you know, Charlize Theron, she practiced and trained and got herself in perfect shape for this film so that you could just stick a camera on her and believe that she's doing all of this stuff. And she's doing it in a way that makes sense, that you don't sit there and say, oh, you know, a guy punches her in the face and this would be over. They actually show how she can use her lithe and limber and strong frame to take on people.
Yeah.
that are...
And not only that, I mean, to be important point to be making here, and you're kind of saying it, but she's doing all of her stunts, or at least I would say the majority of them that are on camera, which is almost unheard of as far as actors taking on roles. We've heard of Daniel Craig doing his own stunts, losing his teeth.
Yeah.
We've heard of other folks, you know...
Jeremy Renner just broke his arm while making the Avengers movie.
Harrison Ford broke an ankle on Star Wars. I mean, it happens. It happens. And here she does this, I think, the scene that will be unparalleled for 2017 and perhaps for 2018 going forward.
It's a great action scene. My problem is, I don't know if I will ever have the urge to watch this movie again because... For whatever reason, I get really offended by movies that think they're smarter than they actually are. And in a spy thriller, not like John Wick, which has a very simple action-oriented plot, this one is trying to come off as twisty-turny with characters that theoretically you're not sure which way they're going, even though it ends up being pretty predictable all the way around. Mm-hmm. And... it's just sort of a dumb story. Not the worst story in the world.
Not at all.
But it paints itself as something smarter.
Smarter than it is.
Than it is. And that drives me crazy. And it was gnawing on me the whole movie. And it's just, it's one of those ones that's like, wow, some awesome action, but it just not doesn't excite me to think about watching this
movie. Yeah, that whole last, I'll call it the last twist. What a twist at the end.
Stupid twist.
Totally not necessary, and you're right. It's one of those things where, it's trying to be too smart for its own good. No contest.
It's a graphic novel twist. Let's be honest here. I mean, it's a twist on top of a twist, and it's totally a graphic novel twist. This is a movie that is based on a graphic novel, which I admittedly have not read, that people love, and people that I respect and admire say is actually really good. But Kirk Johnstad's script, he's the guy that wrote 300. It's like he wants to turn it into a John le Carre novel, you know, like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy or The Spy Who Came from the Cold or The Russia House. But he's so beholden to all of the silliness of a Roger Moore era James Bond movie.
Except for Moonraker.
Moonraker's the worst
I'm
one.
Kidding. I know.
Well,
that's
actually, I just watched A View to a Kill again today, and that one's probably worse.
Oh, come on. That's the one with Zorin. Zorin Industries.
Oh, and Grace Jones is awesome.
Yeah.
But we get off track. It's exactly as you say, though. The movie thinks it's smarter and craftier than it is. I do think it's very entertaining, and it has everything to do with just how stunning Theron is, and not just the action sequences, but she delivers a fantastic performance. McAvoy doesn't necessarily deliver a performance we haven't seen from him before, but he's having such a blast doing it, he's kind of infectious.
Yeah, he goes all in. His character sucks, though. Like that movie would have benefited from just some tweaks to his character where, I don't know, if they had held back just a little bit, and not necessarily him, but the story or the script had held back, I think the movie would have benefited a lot more because then it would have been a lot less clear, like, what's going on with him. And even still, he's still a confusing character.
Yeah. So. He is. Yeah.
So where are you coming in on this? Theater rent skip?
One of the greatest action sequences I've ever seen, and it's an action sequence that deserves to be seen in a theater, rent the movie.
Oh, Sarah. Yeah.
Great action, visually beautiful. But I got to go rent in terms of quality.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm going theater. I'm separating from the pack because I do think the action is worth seeing in theater. And I'm a big supporter of the sound, the rock'em sock'em. So there you go.
There you go.
Okay. A big one that's coming out this week. This comes to us from Catherine Bigelow. Sarah, set up Detroit for us a little bit.
Well, I mean, in a month where we've had a lot of huge, important releases that you could actually attach the Oscar word to.
Yeah.
This one probably deserves to have that attached, whether you love it, hate it, or whatnot. It's going to be in the conversation at the end of the year, right alongside Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk. Detroit is from Catherine Bigelow, the Oscar-winning director of The Hurt Locker, and she's reteaming once again with Mark Boll, the screenwriter of both The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty.
Yeah.
They're telling the story of the 1967 Detroit riots.
Yeah,
but they're even parsing that down even more, and they're telling us a story that should be more well known than it is. It's pretty well known in Detroit, but everywhere
people
else
outside of Detroit,
I had no clue.
Exactly.
And for most of us who are under 50, we don't remember the Detroit riots.
Exactly.
Because it is 50 years to almost the day from when we all saw it.
And that is also part of the point as well.
Yeah.
But basically, during the Detroit race riots, 2 days in, at the Algiers Motel, which is now no longer exists, mm-hmm. and once you watch the movie, you understand why it no longer exists, a group of National Guardsmen, Michigan State Police, and Detroit police officers, along with a lone security guard, believe that they are being fired upon by a sniper from the annex building of the Algiers Motel. Yeah. They go into the Algiers Motel. They put 7 black men and 2 white women up against a wall. At the end of the night, 3 of those people are dead.
Mm-hmm.
That is the movie.
Yeah.
It is a journalistic reaccount of the majority of what is known and what can only be surmised.
Yeah, these are, because this is based on testimony.
It's a lot of testimony. This is a triumph of direction for Bigelow.
Yeah.
I mean, the direction of this movie is spectacular. You never feel for a second that she is out of control, out of her element. The confidence that is on display as far as what she is choosing to show you at any one moment and through whose eyes you are looking at it is extraordinary.
Yeah.
The performances pretty much all across the board, especially from Will Poulter, John Boyega in a couple key scenes where you don't realize just how pent up the emotions inside this character are. Yeah. Catherine Winnick, there's a bunch of people, Anthony Mackie, and just a couple of really great sequences. The acting across the board is extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. Disagree.
And why do you say that? Like, if you're gonna launch a grenade like that,
totally.
back that one up.
I mean, overall, I don't think there was like any performance that stood out as bad to me.
Right.
But come the end of the year or come a year from now, I'm not going to look back and say, oh, wow, that performance in that movie was all that great. I mean, it's a very ensemble movie to some degree, so things tend to blend in naturally. But there were very few standouts to me. Like, the main guy, who I can't remember the actor's name, he was pretty solid.
Algie Smith is Larry.
And Will Poulter is, he was really strong, but his character is so one-sided that it's hard to be like, was this guy really this bad? Yeah. And John Boyega, I actually hated his character. Huh. They didn't do a good job of explaining why the hell he was in this situation, which I know he was in real life, but I was confused the whole time, and I didn't think he was very good.
Here's the thing.
Not bad, just
I think you may be on something where Oscar-wise, it may not necessarily hold it for the actors, but I think SAG-AFTRA Awards or the SAG Awards, when they actually have an award for the best ensemble, I think this may actually be in that discussion.
It should be in that discussion.
So
I think you're wrong on Poulter. I think Poulter is in the conversation for supporting actor just because this character he's playing is so terrifying, and again, based on testimony, not... You know, he's not exactly giving interviews. And of the 3 police officers that were involved, he's the only one that is still alive. And it's not like he's going to go do interviews with Catherine Bigelow and Mark Bull or anybody to talk about this.
And I mean, he goes from We're the Millers, which is what I associate him with. He's this goofy, nerdy guy. Yeah. And he goes to this. And no, I actually thought he was really good. It just didn't completely work for me. But at the same time, if he got nominated for supporting actor, I would have no qualms with it because I totally get it.
And I would disagree with Boyega only because you're dealing with a character who is trying to put his race aside and just do his job and is just supposed to be there because he was a witness. He was somebody that saw things go down.
Wasn't his job to protect that store, though?
Sure.
The grocery.
But because of the sniper, the store is theoretically under assault. So he is doing his job.
Yeah.
There is a scene in the last third of the film where he's taken into an interrogation room by a couple of detectives. And that is when you realize just how fantastic Boyega has been in this movie. Yeah. Because the full weight of everything that has just happened and how that is now suddenly going to get twisted, which is completely historically accurate how it does get twisted.
Yeah.
It all comes clear in large part because of his performance in that room in that moment.
Now, question about this. The film runs 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Yes.
I felt that was long in the tooth, and she could have actually pared down quite a bit of the initial setup, the actual action in the middle, and even towards the end, because it almost has this epilogue to it where you could have cut out 20 minutes of this and it still would have been intact and would have been pretty good.
I do disagree, especially for the opening stuff, and I said this in my review. It's like, what I love about the film is how light on its feet it is early on, where, because you have to understand who these people are who are up against the wall. Mm-hmm. Most notably, the character played by Algie Smith, who was going to be the lead singer of this R&B group called the Dramatics. Who, honestly, I really don't know that well. I'm sure Adam actually knows
them. I don't know the Dramatics.
Okay.
I mean,
apparently they had a couple of big hits, but
they may have. That one's lost on me.
Yeah. But he was going to be, I mean, that was his dream. And you, but he was a nice guy. He and his best friend Larry, I mean, Fred, you know, they loved life. Mm-hmm. They were still kids at heart. And that's the thing that the movie really needs to showcase, is that a lot of these people that were in this situation, they were kids. They were young men. They were, you know, they were 17, 18, 19, other than Anthony Mackie, who was on his way, who was a hero.
Yeah.
Who is coming back as an Army Ranger from Vietnam.
Yeah. Or the Korean.
No, Vietnam. It's Vietnam, 1967.
Right. Yeah.
You know, these are young guys just trying to stay out of trouble.
Yeah.
That's it. And if you don't have those early sequences showing that even in a horrible situation, that there's still fun to be had, there's still dreams to be dreamt, there's still hope to have.
Yeah.
And to see how this event crushes everything.
Yeah.
And I'll
agree with you on that. I think there just still could have been parsing and a lot of just cut down of a number of things, because I think it does run heavy on that.
Yeah, and I'm fine with the length, but at the same time I thought there was some stuff at the beginning and the end that just weren't as well done as the stuff in the middle, which is extremely intense. You know, I mean, pretty much as soon as they get into the full on riot stuff, I mean, it is an intense movie.
Yeah.
You know, through the end of that stuff. But there's a little bit of weakness at the beginning and end, but I don't think length is necessarily the issue.
Okay.
Everything in the hotel is extraordinary.
Sure.
I do think the court case at the end, because we know what the outcome is.
Well, I didn't know. I assumed, but...
Yeah, but I don't know how you cut that, only because that's where you start making the parallels between 1967 and Michael Brown and everything else that's happened in these past, you know, 6-7 years to show how little has changed in 50 years.
So where are you coming in on this? Theater, rent, skip?
I'm a strong theater. I mean, you know, I don't necessarily think it's Bigelow and Bull's best film, but in many ways it might be their most important, and I don't think we can judge it now. I think it's going to be 2, 3, 4, 5 years before we can really judge this one.
Okay.
But definitely a theater.
Okay.
I totally agree with that in terms of, because in my review, I specifically say a week later, I'm still soaking it in, because the more I think about it, the more I have some kind of issue with it, but I still can't put my finger on it. Mm-hmm. But it was a very intense experience, and it is important. So I'm going to go theater, but I think you could easily watch it on video and
get the
be
same,
fine, too. So.
Yeah, and I'm going theater on it as well. In my review, I said, you know, this feels like Bigelow's got her combat boot on our neck, and she's forcing us to watch this.
Yeah.
You must watch this. And she doesn't let up the entire time.
No.
If you feel like a bullet's going to go flying across that screen at any time and you're unnerved the whole time, there's a reason for that. So, all right, Eric, tell us about The Dark Tower. This is the one that everyone keeps asking me about. Tell me about The Dark Tower.
I get lots of people asking me about this, and people who are hearing about it are generally saying, oh, man, I was really looking forward to this one.
Hmm.
So The Dark Tower is based on a 7-part Stephen King book series. It's his epic that he was inspired by Lord of the Rings to do his own thing. It is not at all like Lord of the Rings.
No.
But it is both from a story perspective and the ultimate output of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's essentially about this tower that stands at the middle of multiple universes. And there is this guy named the Gunslinger, or Roland, played by Idris Elba, who his mission is to kill the Man in Black, a man played by Matthew McConaughey, who is trying to destroy the tower, which in turn will destroy the universe, or pull an Avengers and Terra Fabric in space-time and allow a bunch of demons in, or some BS like that.
It's a very Cthulhu kind of thing where...
Yes. Yeah.
The horrors on the other side will come pouring in.
Yeah. And so I am currently reading book 3.
Oh.
And pretty much nothing that has happened so far.
There's the question.
Ends up in the movie. And my friend who I went with is a huge fan of the entire series.
Yeah.
And he said they do pull elements from some of the later stuff. But it honestly baffles me that they didn't try to just make the first movie or the first book, which is a very easy to... pull off
225 pages.
Book, a very Western oriented, and this movie just completely scraps that. But to me, what they really miss is they miss the characters. Idris Elba, great.
I perfectly love cast.
He would be he's perfectly cast, but the character is such a neutered, stereotypical version. And I think part of the problem is that instead of in the books where they tell the story from his perspective, they frame it from the perspective of this kid, Jake, who comes from modern day New York. And so you get this very Chronicles of Narnia or Never Ending Story vibe.
That's the
that
one.
It just doesn't work. And so you have all these very flat characters.
Yeah.
And of course, it's a freaking 90-minute movie supposed to cover 7 crazy weird books. So I don't know what they were thinking.
When I heard it was a 90-minute movie, I was actually excited because I thought, okay, they're going to adapt the first book. The first book's like 225, 240 pages, something like that, depending on which version you get. 90 minutes is kind of perfect for that.
Totally.
It's an intro. It gets you excited. It's going to show us who this character is. It sets up the world. It's a perfect chance for McConaughey and Elba to just go at each other, mano a mano. This is going to be great. It's going to be down and dirty, and Howard has shown he can direct some of this stuff. I'm all in. And then you watch the movie and you're like, okay, well, this is just incoherent.
Hmm.
It's like a bunch of fantasy vignettes pulled from 75 different movies and stories and books that in and of themselves are kind of cool.
Yeah.
I mean, a few of the... If you take like a 10-minute snippet by itself and were just to watch it, you'd be like, hey, I want to see that movie. But the problem is none of the little 10-minute snippets fit with any of the other 10-minute snippets.
Scene by scene, it works, and they got some weird stuff.
Yeah.
But all together, it's just like you're rushing from one thing to the next. Yeah. And it's like, you know, you got that stupid sky laser beam that is in every freaking movie these days. I mean, my God.
Attacking from the air.
Yeah. And made from the screams of children. Oh, sorry, the shine of children. I mean, come on.
And you're point about the Never Ending Story is perfect because it's sort of like the Stephen King version of the Never Ending Story, but only because of how ruthless it is. Mm. Not because it has any of the wit or the imagination or the nuance. It's just got, and it doesn't even have the wit, the nuance, and the imagination of the books.
Yeah.
It just has the ruthlessness of King. I mean, there's a couple little plot twists that happen that are straight out of Stephen King with like characters that you think you're going to like that, let's just say something happens.
Right.
Adam, what about you?
So, well, I'm sitting on the other side of this, and I'm going, I haven't read any of the books.
Yeah.
I watched the film, and I said, you know, I actually genuinely kind of enjoyed this because I thought they were actually very efficient with the 90 minutes that they had. They do set up a world. They do give they round out their characters, and you get enough background and enough information about the characters to understand what their motivations are, what's driving them. We get enough character development going on there that they actually are being quite efficient with the time. I actually did think that the beats of the action paced the film in a way that kept it moving forward. Yes, they are a bit discoherent, but again, we're also dealing with sci-fi. So I'm kind of going, all right, I get how this all fits together. And here's the weird thing. Did this happen to you? I felt like the time-space continuum was broken in this film because sometimes I'm watching this going, Jesus, we've accomplished a ton in this film. How long have we been in here? Have we been in here for 2 hours? Turns out, nope, 90 minutes. I didn't even know what the runtime was going into it. So to me, it felt a lot longer than it was. And we actually, like, lights come on in the theater. And
it
we
felt
turn on
longer
our,
to me, too.
Everyone turns on their phone. It's like, it's 8:30. What?
Well, 8:30? When you say time-space continuum, do you mean that you think that they were breaking their linear...
No. I mean our time-space continuum.
Oh, okay.
Like the fact that we've been sitting there for 90 minutes, yet it felt like 3 hours.
Okay.
I'm saying.
Oh. I'm actually not surprised by your reaction because I was sitting there trying to watch because I was like pretty early on, I'm like, oh man, this is a struggle.
Yeah.
And I'm not even like a diehard fan of the books.
Mm-hmm.
I'm only through a couple of them and I didn't like book number 2, but I was trying to sit there and I was like, if I knew nothing about the books, could I at least be entertained by this? And I was like, probably. I wasn't entertained that much, but I could see it.
Well,
so
here's the thing. I mean, I was entertained, but again, kind of what the two of you are driving at is that there are so many young adult sci-fi films. The Maze Runner, Insurgent, Divergent, The Hunger Games, I Am Number 4. I mean, the list goes on and on. We've been exposed to so many of these things, and most of them don't have the inertia or the momentum to break Earth's gravity. This one doesn't either, unfortunately, in my opinion. So while I'm entertained, I don't think it has the legs to carry it quite like something like Hunger Games managed to initially that just lit the country on fire and got it going.
And the Maze Runner sort of is, because that one is still, that's still continuing and people seem to like it. So, I mean, you got to give it a little bit of...
I like the Maze Runner movies.
I do, yeah.
Okay, but, well, I'm less enthused, but...
I don't know why you had to put it through the eyes. And I actually think the young actor, Tom Taylor, who plays Jake, I think he's actually quite good in the movie.
He's fine.
I just don't know why we need to see it through his eyes.
Yeah. Because one final note is reading the books and still not knowing where they go, the whole thing's a mystery. Roland in the books, he doesn't even know why he wants to go to the Dark Tower. He just knows he needs to go. And so he's driven by this mysterious force, and everything is a mystery. In the first couple minutes of this movie, they lay out exactly everything with this cheesy, you know, child scream thing, and Matthew McConaughey sort of just looking a little makeuped up, and
he's embodying Christopher Walken as Archangel Gabriel from The Prophecy.
We were walking out, and there was a lot of mixed reaction to McConaughey. I liked McConaughey in this movie. I thought if he would have had just even a tiny bit more room to just really let go, he's having a blast playing the most evil dude in all of creation.
It was a very flat character to me, but I don't think it was his fault. I think he was well cast, just the role was not written well enough.
There are other big actors that are in this movie though who get nothing to do.
Right. Yeah. So I'm thinking Allstate Insurance is one of them.
There you go.
just saying. So so where were you guys coming in on this?
Skip
from Eric.
Yeah,
Sarah?
I mean, I don't want to be a skip because again, I like portions of it, and I think Elba, I love him as this character.
Go with Skip, Sarah.
But the movie doesn't work. It's a skip.
Oh, wow. And I'm being lighter on it. I still think it's a rental. I think it's fun to watch. Again, young adult sci-fi action, just not enough to break gravity.
All right.
So it goes. Al Gore's got his hands on another inconvenient sequel.
Yes, Truth to Power.
Truth to Power. And Al Gore was actually here in town doing interviews. Did you get a chance to sit down with him at all?
No, I wanted to, but I mean, he only sat down with a couple people. And unfortunately, you know, MovieFreak.com and the Seattle Gay News do not equal the Seattle Times and, you know, any of your television stations.
I just got thrown in a Secret Service room after I tried to run towards him. So don't do that.
Except that he didn't bring a Secret Service with him.
Security agents.
Yeah, he didn't bring security agents with him.
Oh, well, then, not only that, he declares himself a recovering politician.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of interesting in its
own
right.
I did like that line.
So, inconvenient sequel.
Sure.
This is one of those films bringing up climate change, global warming.
Sure.
10 years after his last film.
Yep.
On this, which was criticized often by the far right.
Stupidly.
Well, speaking from liberal Seattle's perspective.
Yeah, well, let's just speak from a scientific's perspective.
Right, and
they're
I agree.
Stupid.
Agreed, right? No contest on that either.
Science is still science.
But here's the interesting thing. So
we have this
compelling argument. All you have to do is turn on the news. All we have to do right now is
walk outside
and feel the burning in our eyes from the fires up in BC and knowing that just how connected the world is, right?
Yeah, let's just say it's almost 100 in Seattle, people, when you're listening to this right now.
So there is that to take into consideration. Here's my beef with this film, though. We have a very important message. This is a weak modifier. Can we find a more charismatic person to deliver the message than Al Gore? Don't get me wrong. I think Al Gore's fantastic. He's wonderful. He's got a great message. But it is literally like watching a tick of broccoli speak to me. I get so bored to tears.
I actually don't mind Al Gore giving the message. I think he does. I think he's a fine messenger.
Mm.
My issue is, so the first like 2/3 of the movie, it takes the inconvenient truth out of the PowerPoint, which I love.
Sure.
And it sort of like brings the PowerPoint out into the real world where you can see what has happened over the last 10 years. That stuff's great.
Yep.
The last third of the movie is all sent, at the Global Climate Change Summit.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, we all know how that has gone now.
Thanks,
Trump. But there's like this... there's like this roadblock at the Paris Accords. And the movie is constructed in a way to make it look like Al Gore is the superhero of climate change.
Sure.
That without Al Gore, the Paris Climate Accords never would have happened. And then at the very end of that, there's like a little line where he says, oh, thank goodness for Barack Obama and John Kerry and some of those other, you know, he's like, he But the movie, the way the movie is edited and shown, makes it look like the only way the Paris Climate Accords ever happened is with Al Gore.
That's a good observation, although I actually like that part the most.
Really?
Because, the first part, and I don't have a problem with Al Gore. Yeah. My problem is that the movie spends too much time talking about Al Gore and Al Gore. Like, no, punch me in the gut like you did with the first one about the climate. It's like, just repeat. You could have repeated the first one, taken it out of the PowerPoint.
Yeah.
And that would have been a lot more powerful to me than hearing about Al Gore's life story over the last 10 years.
You know what's powerful? The end of the movie where Al Gore goes to that little Texas town.
That's more important to me.
And meets with a Republican mayor
that is
in
a
Republican dominated city in the most Republican county in all of Texas.
Yes.
And they go, hey, we're going to be energy self-sufficient.
Agree. And exactly because
100%.
Exactly what we're showing right here is that this is not a partisan issue.
No.
This is a life issue. This is a climate issue.
Economic issue.
Yes.
And that's more to the point. Maybe that is the unifying factor here where we can bring Republicans and Democrats together on this and find some solution that
works. That's the great part of that moment. Yeah. Is like that Republican's like, he's sitting there going, we've cut our power bills by like 70% and we've put people to work.
Yeah. And he goes, I'm a
CPA. They vote for me.
And I'm a CPA. I was like, okay, there you go.
Yeah. So to that point, I think where the movie fails is it tries to tell a story about how things have gone on versus trying to convince you of those things. I mean, obviously it has some of that.
Sure.
It doesn't do as good of a job as the first.
It's still good. Yes, exactly. It's just not the gut punch that the first one was.
So do you want to see this in the theater or rental?
It's a rental. I told everybody to see the first one in the theater because it was so important and so well made and it was a gut punch. This one's still good. It's still well made and it's got vital information in it and it's really well delivered. Yeah. But it's a rent.
Yeah. Rental. It'll probably be on Netflix in a month. So.
Yeah. Agree. Yeah, all around. I would say sip a cup of coffee before you go so you can stay awake through some of the droll parts.
There you go.
We are technically at the midway point of 2017.
Well, we would have been had we not gone on Adam not gone on vacation.
But you know what?
So we're going to say
vacation is important.
Exactly.
Taking time out.
So we're
going to
say midpoint plus one.
Mm-hmm. So midpoint of the year.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of films.
Yes.
What are we agreeing here or what are you disagreeing on? Let's just kind of do a round robin around the room of our top five films. Eric, why don't you start us off here? What number five for you?
Number five, I'm going to go with, of course, it's a little hazy. My top two were easy. The rest are sort of in a bubble.
Yeah, and that's how they should be right now.
Yeah, but number five, I'm going to go with John Wick 2. I had a blast watching that.
No kidding. Yeah, I don't disagree. I think that was a lot of fun. Yeah.
It's a strong film.
Sarah, how about you?
I keep, again, like Eric just said, I mean, when you get into my like 4 through 15, I think they're all fantastic. Any of them could move this way or that. I would probably right now go with, this is going to kill me. You know what? I am going to go with Their Finest, the other Dunkirk movie of the year.
Hmm.
With my favorite actress.
Yes, with your favorite actress who's remarkable in that movie.
So I've heard. Yeah. I think you were going to loan me that movie.
Oh, sure.
Right?
Yes, yeah. I will. I'll let you still borrow it.
Okay, so number
one. Gemma Arterton in Their Finest. And it's about the home front in Britain, and it's how how people were using cinema to get people excited and eager to fight the war both home and abroad.
Called propaganda.
Yeah, the propaganda machines, I recall. Yep. Yeah,
and they make a movie about Dunkirk.
Yeah,
so it's our second Dunkirk movie.
So your five is Their Finest. My number five comes in as Logan. I'm going to say Logan was just entertaining enough and tugged on the heartstrings enough. I appreciate the good old Hugh Jackman.
I actually forgot about Logan because that might have moved into my five spot. So.
Where are you coming in at number four?
Number four, I'm going to go with Dunkirk.
Mm.
Walking out of the theater, I was like, that was pretty good. As I wrote my review, I'm like, okay, that was a pretty unique experience.
Mm-hmm.
I maybe am not fully raving about it. Obviously, it's at my number four, but I think it's a experience that needs to be seen on the big screen.
And Christopher Nolan does a fantastic job with that movie.
Does that appear on your radar at all, Sarah?
It might.
Okay.
And I know it's not on yours,
Adam. It is not with me. I just real quick on that, I appreciate the aesthetics. I appreciate the cinematography and the sound design and all that. I just was disappointed with any character development or lack thereof.
Oh,
and
God.
And therefore, the film starts to fail for me.
See, this is why we should have recorded earlier in the month, because now we would have argued.
So, there you go. Anyway, Sarah, where's your four come in?
Well, as we're going to conclude July releases, I'm going to go with War of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh.
War for the Planet of the Apes is maybe, it's stunning.
Mm-hmm.
What Matt Reeves accomplishes with this final chapter and this new entry into the Planet of the Apes series is just extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And the level of humanity, empathy, and just insight that exists in this movie is something else. It's not the movie I think people expected, especially for a movie called War of the Planet of the Apes, because there's only like two action sequences in the entire movie.
Yeah.
But I think it's genius.
Yeah.
And Andy Serkis, somebody needs to give him an Oscar of some sort. I don't care if it's a special Oscar, because I mean, obviously they're never going to nominate him for acting because it's a motion capture performance.
Yeah.
But he needs one,
because
good God, what does this guy have to
do? That movie is great. I still don't like the ending to that movie. The whole avalanche bit is just
okay. For me, number four is that little film called Free Fire. It was goofy. It was wacky. It was just fun, and it was an adventure from start to finish about drugs, guns, all heists gone wrong, and you know, just simple little story, just kind of fun.
Free Fire. I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
it's good.
All right, Eric, number three.
So number three, I was trying to mix things up a little bit because I bet you guys won't have this one. So I went with Gifted.
Hmm.
Oh, good movie.
Yeah,
love that movie.
It's like wears its emotions on its sleeve. You know, predictable to the end, but. Really entertaining. Yeah.
Totally agree. I went with the Adam's favorite Romanian movie, Graduation.
Oh.
Our Christian Mingiu movie.
No, you
that
will not.
That is a
I like that?
No, maybe. I don't know, because lately you've been liking things that I can't quite.
But statistically, I would not.
Statistically, you would not. I think it's extraordinary, and it's going to be, it's almost a lock to make my top 10 at the end of the year at this point.
Okay. Number three for me comes in as Baby Driver. I thought that was just too fun, and again, also going for the fun factor, soundtrack alone makes that one worth the price of admission, and you know, it's just, again, another shoot 'em up, rah-rah-rah kind of film.
Lots of fun.
Yeah. Number two for you?
My number two, I'm going with The Big Sick. Seen it twice, loved it.
Great
drama, great comedy, just all-around good movie.
Great movie.
Just, they probably should have stopped it 5 minutes sooner. It drags at the end, but yeah. Great movie.
Okay.
I'm going with Francois Ozon's latest movie, France.
Hmm.
It's just poetic and dreamy, and it's set just right after World War I, and it's made me bawl every time I watched it.
Wow.
And okay. I adore it.
Right.
I don't even know what else to say.
Sure. Number two for me sits as Get Out. I think again we see just a new shade of of what a comedic guy can do to turn the standards or whatever on its ear of a horror genre and do something completely fun and interesting. And I just love that through and through.
I wish I liked the horror elements of that movie more, but I think that might be my favorite script of the year.
Yeah, there you go. Number one, Eric.
We're going to have to disagree because Get Out is my number one.
No way!
There you go.
All right.
Well, and we're going to have to disagree again, but this time a little bit more vehemently, because Dunkirk is my number one.
Shut the front door.
No, Dunkirk might be a masterpiece. It's likely Christopher Nolan's best film.
Disagree. Disagree through and through. I love the boats. No. I disagree with everything else.
You're wrong. So,
no.
It's up there with The Thin Red Line.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, my number one is going to shock the heck out of you. What do you, Sarah, you've gotten to know my tastes over the years. If you had to surmise or speculate, Brian Zitzelman once used to do Kreskin.
Oh, I know.
And he would have us pegged, generally, every time. If you had to pick one.
Transformers.
No.
Not
even close. Split?
No.
Okay.
A Ghost Story.
I was just going to, that was my, man.
A Ghost Story.
I was just going to say that next.
A Ghost Story comes in as my number one, purely out of the fact that I am still thinking about it weeks after watching that. And it sits with me as a thinker. It was interesting. For as little as that actually happens on screen, it still got me thinking.
It's an interesting movie.
Yeah.
It's one I usually wouldn't like, and it, I know, and you liked it. I was really absorbed the whole time. I still think it's one of those ones where it wants to cast itself as smarter than it actually is, but I was absorbed the whole time.
Yeah. The one or two that just missed that you think people should see?
I'll leave it at that. Guardians of the Galaxy, maybe? I don't know. No. Fun. I don't know.
Oh, you guys.
Yeah, but I'm more curious about the ones that like fall on the failure list. Did you pick a failure?
Well, I think the worst movie I've seen is Transformers, okay. The Last Knight. I think probably my most disappointing film is probably Beauty and the Beast.
Interesting.
Okay. Those annoyed me.
For me, I think I'm right there with you on Transformers. Don't get me wrong. That's a heaping pile. But I was also disappointed with what we saw the other night in Kidnapped and Halle Berry.
I can't go with that.
I sat there. We're supposed to be watching this mom in fear of her child's life, and they keep cutting away to the dash of the car, speeding up to a whopping 60 miles an hour. Whoa! Watch out.
She is in a minivan.
But that's even more.
I've got
the point.
My parents' minivan up to like 80. So yeah.
See, and they do actually have one scene where it gets to 80, and that is it. Come on, Eric, did you pick a least favorite?
So I didn't see Transformers, but I'm going with The Great Wall, which featured Matt Damon's worst performance.
No.
Poor monster design. Those monsters were so generic. It just all around just crappy movie.
That was a pile indeed. So, all right.
Sarah loved it, though.
Apparently. I did not. I admire what Zhang Yimou, the director, I admire what he does visually in that film. Mm-hmm. I think the visual stylistics of that movie and what he does as far as the Asian cultural side of that movie are very interesting and fascinating, and I love those elements.
I agree. It would have made a beautiful 10-minute short film.
It would have been better had the movie been in Chinese and just had...
Not
some titles in there? Yeah. All right. Yeah. So in review, summary, we're saying Inconvenient Sequel. That's getting 3 rentals from the Squabblers. Atomic Blonde getting 2 rentals and a theater recommendation. Detroit getting 3 strong theater recommendations. And The Dark Tower getting 2 skips and 1 rental from the Squabblers. So that's kind of the review of what we're talking about here, plus everything else we've just kind of rattled off. Sarah, you work on any other special projects right about now?
At the moment, I've just got a ton of interviews, most of them carried over from the Seattle National Film Festival, because all of those movies are now coming out into theaters.
Yeah.
So I have just been uploading interview after interview after interview lately. So check those out.
Very good. Eric, how about you?
I am the complete opposite. I'm planning on winding down for the summer and taking a couple weeks off as we deal with the crappiness that comes in the second half of August, usually.
Is true.
Well, although there's some good buzz on stuff that we're seeing in the next couple weeks.
Yeah.
We shall see.
I'll see a couple things, but you won't be seeing anything special for me.
Okay. Well, so Cinema Squabble, episode number 60, keeping it short and sweet so Eric can get home and have dinner with his sweets. There you have it.
I got a text. She was like, I got hungry, so I ate some taquitos.
She started without you?
So, yeah.
Oh, man. Did you go for the meatballs?
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
I want tacos. Can we get tacos?
Let's see if we can order in on that. I bet Amazon delivers or Uber delivers or something delivers by now. Episode number 60. Thanks much, Sarah Michelle Fetters, Eric Samdel, Adam Gerke, and our producer, Sprints Arbogast. Thanks for joining us.